getting richer and those that are getting poorer. So the quotes of the billionaires and how many people are falling into extreme poverty are really striking at this moment in our history. And what we're finding is in East Africa, for example, it's not that people are working less hard, they're working more hard. They are, you know, walking for miles to try to find water, trying to find a pasture or food for their animals. They are doing everything they can to keep their families alive. They are skipping meals, often one meal a day, and sometimes the parents aren't eating. We know that women are eating last or not at all, and they're also preparing any meals that they can find, and they're also responsible for finding those meals. So the billionaires aren't working harder. It's because of the circumstances of the pandemic that they've been able to make a lot of money. And so we really need to think about that. When we have right now in East Africa, there is a humanitarian assistance, it's about $4.4 billion, but we only have 3% of the funding. We have funding going to Ukraine, but not to places like East Africa. And in terms of extreme hunger, you know, there is a classification that looks at malnutrition. It looks at water that's available in houses. It looks at how many meals people eat a day. So there's all these factors that it looks at, and it determines where it is. Is it extreme hunger? Is it famine? And it's called IPC 12345. And right now in East Africa, we are in 3, 4, and 5, and 5 is famine. So those are the emergency categories based on people's access to food, based on availability of clean water, and based on the number of calories they're able to take in a day.
Well, Shannon Scribner, we thank you for being with us, leading Oxfam America's humanitarian work. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeitberg, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkofte, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-charge bookkeeper. Do you have accounting and administrative experience? Do you enjoy working in a highly collaborative team environment? Are you looking for a workplace with a mission? Or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the full-charge bookkeeper and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, June 12th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. KBOO's financial health is our focus. Help us foster it.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 7th Annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. The Vanport Mosaic is back with its annual Memory Activism Festival to, quote, remember, repair, reclaim, and reimagine our collective story. The festival will center on the 80th anniversary of the building of Vanport, once Oregon's second largest city, and the largest World War II federal housing project in the United States. Highlights include Vanport the Musical and a panel discussion on Portland's past, present, and future of affordable housing. Again, that's the 7th Annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Stand by me.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council approves new zoning laws. Pacific Northwest leaders update their recommendations for the drought this summer. And in international news, monkeypox vaccine efforts in developed countries highlights healthcare discrimination faced by African countries. evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 1st, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The Portland City Council approved new changes to its zoning laws today. Experts say that the changes will help add much-needed density and housing options for Portland residents facing a housing affordability crisis. One change is the legalization of townhomes across the city, which were once outlawed. This type of housing is popular in larger cities. It's expected that townhomes can increase housing density and housing diversity, meaning homebuyers could purchase a smaller lot that shares a structure with its neighbors. It could also mean that fewer Portland residents will be priced out of their city. Cottage clusters and backlot homes are also now legal under the zoning law approval today. Before the update, those involved in the building of these types of housing would have to create a custom carve-out in zoning rules and risk backlash from neighbors. Fourplexes, sixplexes, and larger accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, will also now face lessened restrictions under the new zoning laws. Portland took steps to reform its residential zoning laws in 2020, and housing advocates said the changes didn't go far enough to ensure the city is livable and affordable for homeowners into the future. This effort is part of many others that lawmakers across levels of government in the state are making to address the housing affordability crisis in Oregon. As of today, June 1st, the western part of Washington State is no longer under a drought order. But portions of Washington east of the Cascade Mountains will remain under an emergency drought declaration this summer. These areas, in north central and eastern Washington, include parts of a number of counties, including Spokane, Lincoln, Grant, Adams, Whitmans, Stevens, Okanagan, and Ponderay counties. They represent about 9% of the state. Practically, this means there will continue to be low soil moisture, dried up ponds, and earlier irrigation limits. Some areas, like Okanagan County in north central Washington, could see low water in storage reservoirs. Areas under emergency drought conditions have reported shallow groundwater levels, which can be a concern for private well users in rural areas who could run out of water. Low levels of shallow groundwater could also mean less water for livestock that depend on ponds and springs. Experts say animal owners might have to haul water or move cattle to where the water is, off the open ranges. The declaration empowers the Department of Ecology to conduct emergency water rights transfers. This allows junior water rights holders, who are typically the first to have to stop using water, to use water rights from senior water rights holders. Water rights transfers can take years, but the streamlined emergency transfer process can happen within 15 days. Last spring marked the second driest in Washington. The record-breaking heat wave in June led to 96% of the state falling under an emergency drought declaration. The Washington drought is actually much less severe than what was seen last year. Recent spring rains have helped. In Oregon, Governor Kate Brown added new areas to a list detailing those facing severe water shortages last April. Forecasts don't predict any improvement. The U.S. Drought Monitor lists Central Oregon in an exceptional drought, the highest level of risk. It also shows the southern part of Idaho in moderate, severe, or extreme drought. The Idaho Department of Water Resources declared an emergency drought declaration for all 34 counties south of the Salmon River, also in April. The Washington State Department of Ecology downgraded the rest of central and eastern Washington to a drought advisory status, meaning residents should be vigilant when using water. Those who study trauma created by violence, including the recent mass shootings in Uvalde in Buffalo, New York, say the deadly assaults make people feel helpless when it comes to creating a better society. The latest incidents have prompted the American Federation of Teachers to launch a national Enough is Enough campaign. Roz Brown has more.
Teachers, faith leaders, and parents gathered Tuesday outside the Austin office of U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. They're demanding action on gun safety as part of a new Enough is Enough campaign by the American Federation of Teachers. An expert in violence prevention says school leaders report the past year has been their hardest, both for behavioral problems and mental health concerns. Beverly Kingston at the University of Colorado's Center for Study and Prevention of Violence says huge social stressors have created a perfect storm. They include uncertainties around COVID-19, concerns about natural disasters and climate change, the increasing polarization of society and domestic terrorism.
There are so many answers and so many solutions, and we are failing to put those into place. We're failing to understand what those all are as a nation, and we're failing to put those things that we can do into place.
The AFT campaign paints gun violence as a public health issue with not only psychological effects on kids, teachers, and families, but medical consequences that strain the healthcare system. Kingston, who has studied school shootings for decades, says research-backed solutions for decreasing school violence often lack the funds to be implemented. For example, she says a middle school bullying prevention program may have helped the 18-year-old who killed 19 students and two teachers last week in Uvalde.
If we want this violence to end, we need to be investing significant resources. I really think billions of dollars, not millions of dollars, billions of dollars. It's not a quick fix.
The reality, says Kingston, is the horse is out of the barn, meaning there are millions of guns in the hands of Americans, and lawmakers are still stuck at policy-level discussions, rather than focusing on the motivations for why young men buy weapons for nefarious reasons.
So even with the very best policy, it's likely that someone could still access a gun if they wanted to. But we can make it harder, and making it harder does seem to work.
The Uvalde massacre marked the 213th mass shooting and the 27th school shooting so far this year, according to the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
School counselors are a critical resource for students in stressful and troubling times. However, some counselors say their importance in schools is often overlooked and that Oregon needs more people to fill this role. Eric Tegetoff has more on this story.
Students' mental health has been strained, from the pandemic to the tragic school shooting in Texas last week. Counselors can be a lifeline for kids dealing with stressful times. Rebecca Pierce, a counselor at Klamath Union High School, says kids were struggling before the pandemic, but COVID-19 has added a new level of anxiety, including for those who may not have struggled before. Pierce says one important approach counselors take is understanding the student is not the problem, the problem is the problem.
You can help lessen student anxiety when you allow them to tell their stories, when you allow them to truthfully and appropriately, you know, tell their stories and explore some of these scary things.
In the wake of the Texas shooting, Pierce says it's been hard for counselors, too, to cope with the tragedy. She also notes there's a lack of counselors working at the elementary school level. Roberto Aguilar is a counselor at Milwaukee High School. He says there's a lot of focus in high school on the future and what life holds for students when they graduate. But he thinks people should dial back their expectations of the future and focus on more immediate issues.
One of my big concerns is we need to start living today and realizing that today, the present, really is the priority and really is the gift that we need to focus on.
The American School Counselor Association recommends one counselor for every 250 students. Aguilar says to meet that goal, Oregon would have to hire more than 740 counselors. Pierce agrees the counselor's role often is overlooked.
There kind of seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding of what school counselors can do and also why districts would, especially I think in our rural areas, want to spend that money to hire more school counselors. So there's really a lot more education needed.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
House Democrats push forward on new gun control legislation in the wake of the Uvalde school shooting, and a Trump aide has been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury. With those stories and more, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Weapon to more mass shooting aftermaths than I think any president in American history, unfortunately.
In the wake of last week's mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, President Joe Biden says he'll be meeting with congressional leaders to find common ground on gun control. Meanwhile, House Democrats are pushing forward with several gun control bills. The chamber is technically on break this week, but Democratic leaders have scheduled a special Judiciary Committee session for Thursday, with an aim to pass eight bills on for a floor vote as soon as possible. The measures probably will sail through the Democrat-controlled House, but they face likely defeat in the 50-50 Senate. That means Biden's hands are functionally tied, although White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says he is weighing potential executive actions.
This president has done more executive actions at this point than any other president. He cannot do this alone. Congress needs to act so we can have federal law legislation on the books.
Former Donald Trump aide Peter Navarro has been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury on his alleged involvement with the January 6th insurrection. The New York Times reports the hearing is tentatively set for Thursday, although Navarro has asked a federal judge to block the subpoena while he challenges its legality. The White House has outlined a new plan to tackle rising inflation. The multi-part strategy involves lowering costs of everyday goods by improving the supply chain and lowering the federal deficit. In a news conference, National Economic Council Director Brian Deese said Biden also will be reinforcing the independent authority of the Federal Reserve, the nation's central bank.
Which is critically important, particularly at a moment where inflation is elevated, but cannot be taken for granted, which is why the president is reinforcing it publicly today.
Michael Sussman, a former attorney for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, has been found not guilty of lying to the FBI about Trump's ties to Russia. CNN reports Sussman was charged with supplying a false tip, which led to a four-month investigation into the former president's potential relationship with the Russian-linked Alpha Bank. Speaking outside the courtroom today, Sussman denied any wrongdoing. He's previously argued the tip was made in good faith and not as a campaign tactic.
I told the truth to the FBI, and the jury clearly recognized that with their unanimous verdict today.
The suit against Sussman was brought by John Durham, a Justice Department special counsel appointed by Trump 3 years ago to investigate the investigations of the former president's alleged connections to Russia. And finally, the South Korean pop band BTS made a stop at the White House Tuesday to speak out against violence against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. According to the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, anti-Asian hate crimes were up more than 300% last year compared with 2020. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on how increased housing development alone won't stop rents from rising. KBOO's Althea Billings interviews Piper McDaniel, a Street Roots investigative reporter, about her new article on the topic. At 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 77. Today in history, in 1926, American television actor and comedian Andy Griffith was born. Griffith was known for his roles in The Andy Griffith Show and Matlock, as well as a number of movie roles. The quote of the day is from Oscar award-winning actor Morgan Freeman, who was also born today in 1937. Freeman said, "Learning how to be still, to be really still and let life happen, that stillness becomes our radiance." A lawsuit found 3 South Dakota agencies violated voter registration protections for Rosebud and Oglala Sioux tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. 3 South Dakota agencies have violated the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. That's the opinion released last week in response to a lawsuit filed by the Rosebud and Oglala Sioux tribes. A federal district judge found that the Secretary of State, the Department of Social Services, and the Department of Public Safety all failed to uphold the law designed to make it simpler for people to register to vote. Victoria Wicks reports.
When the Native American Rights Fund filed this lawsuit in September 2020, then NARF attorney Natalie Landreth said the complaint focused on a complex law with a simple purpose.
It's supposed to be easy to register, and it's supposed to be offered to you when you interact with the state at a number of different points.
Landreth said in 2004, when the state followed federal law, 7,000 voter registration applications originated from public agencies. But 12 years later, that number dropped to 1,100 when the state no longer complied.
As a result, you're seeing a significant decline in voter registration in South Dakota.
In his recent opinion, Federal District Judge Lawrence Pearsall found that South Dakota's Departments of Social Services and Public Safety both violated federal law in several ways. One example is that agencies asked applicants to opt in for voter registration assistance, but they are required to offer those services routinely unless the client wants to opt out. Another example, if someone does not have a Social Security number, a state ID card, or a driver's license, state agencies are required to assign a voter identification number. Instead, state employees were sending those clients to the county auditor, even in rural areas and in Indian country, where it might be a long trip to the county seat. Judge Pearsall placed the blame for these and other problems mainly on the Secretary of State, in this case, Steve Barnett. The judge noted that Barnett chairs the State Board of Elections and is responsible for enforcing the federal act. He said Barnett had failed to provide proper training and oversight and had given out inaccurate information to state employees. Judge Pearsall did not grant summary judgment to the plaintiffs on certain factual matters where witnesses need to be called and evidence presented. Those issues can continue to be litigated. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Biden administration has released a new tool for tribes to help them navigate investments in the bipartisan infrastructure law. Officials from the Departments of Health and Human Services, Environmental Protection Agency, Interior Department, and the White House announced the Tribal Playbook Tuesday during a press call. The playbook is intended to help tribal governments access benefits from the infrastructure law, which includes more than $13 billion for Indian Country. Brian Newland, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, says the Bureau of Indian Affairs sought feedback from tribes. Newland says tribal leaders expressed a need for more information for funding, capacity building, technical assistance, and speeding up the permitting process. He says, along with the playbook, the BIA is expanding its work to help tribes.
We're creating an infrastructure law interagency coordinating position here within Indian Affairs at the Department of the Interior so that we can help Indian Country navigate these resources. And we've issued a national policy memo directing the Bureau of Indian Affairs to prioritize permitting for any infrastructure projects so that these critical dollars can reach Indian Country as quickly as possible.
Infrastructure law investments for the Interior Department include funding for water rights settlements, dam safety, climate change, and orphaned wells. Funding for other agencies address transportation, sanitation, broadband, drinking water, and other areas. The Tribal Playbook can be found online at build.gov. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The large number of canceled flights over the Memorial Day weekend may predict for significant troubles for travelers planning to fly this summer. United States Airlines canceled more than 2,800 flights from Thursday through Monday, or about 2% of their schedules. Delta Airlines, usually a reliable performer, had the worst record among major carriers, with more than 800 canceled flights over those 5 days. Analysts were hoping that last year's issues would not be repeated this summer, but bad weather, air traffic control holdups, airline crew members calling in sick, and long security lines at some airports all contributed to the recent delays. Rising COVID-19 cases among workers have also been a problem. Delta conducted 13% more flights in May than it did a year ago, but the airline announced last week that it would cut its schedules for July and August by up to 3% to make the remaining flights more reliable. Forecasts of high numbers of travelers over the Memorial Day weekend proved to be accurate. More than 11 million people were screened at airport checkpoints from Thursday through Monday. That was down 9% from the same days in 2019, but represented an increase of almost 25% over last year. The figures of just under 2.4 million on both Thursday and Friday almost matched the pandemic high set on the Thanksgiving weekend Sunday last year. Flights that were not canceled were, in general, packed because airline schedules still have not returned to pre-pandemic levels. The U.S. airline industry actually hopes to push passenger numbers higher, in part by removing one of the last U.S. pandemic-related travel restrictions. Industry representatives met yesterday with White House officials to repeat their request to end the requirement that travelers test negative for COVID-19 within a day of flying into the United States. Lifting that requirement would lead to 4.3 million more international passengers over 1 year. Many Americans appear unwilling to travel overseas because they could be stranded if they contract the virus on their trip. Flight cancellations were down sharply on Tuesday. The Department of Justice asked a federal judge to overturn the decision last month that ended the national mask mandate for travel. Their appeal says the mandate fell well within the scope of the CDC's authority, which was the issue at play. Since then, airlines and rideshare companies have made masks optional. Health authorities in Europe and the United States are rolling out vaccines and considering the use of antiviral drugs to stamp out the biggest monkeypox outbreak seen beyond Africa. Meanwhile, the African continent has reported more than 5 times as many cases this year. Some doctors say the resources to slow the disease's spread have long been available, just not to Africans. Countries including Great Britain, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Switzerland, the United States, Israel, and Australia have reported more than 250 monkeypox cases, some tied to sexual activity at 2 recent raids in Europe. No deaths have been reported. There have also been more than 1,400 monkeypox cases and 63 deaths in 4 countries where the disease is endemic: Cameroon, Central African Republic, Congo, and Nigeria. Monkeypox is in the same family of viruses as smallpox, and smallpox vaccines are estimated to be about 85% effective against that disease. Great Britain has recently vaccinated more than 1,000 people at risk of contracting the virus and bought 20,000 more doses. U.S. government officials have released about 700 doses of vaccine to states where cases were reported. But such measures are not routinely employed in Africa. For example, there are currently no vaccines or antivirals being used in Nigeria. People suspected of having monkeypox are isolated and treated conservatively while their contacts are monitored. Generally, Africa has only had small stockpiles of smallpox vaccine to offer health workers when monkeypox outbreaks happen, according to the African Centers for Disease Control. This appears to be due to limited vaccine supply and competing health priorities. The World Health Organization has 31 million doses of smallpox vaccines, mostly kept in donor countries and intended as a rapid response to any reemergence of the disease, which was declared eradicated in 1980. Dr. Mike Ryan, WHO's emergencies chief, said the agency was considering allowing developed countries to use the smallpox vaccines to try to limit the spread of monkeypox. WHO manages similar mechanisms to help poor countries get vaccines for diseases like yellow fever and meningitis, but such efforts have not previously been used for countries that can otherwise afford vaccines. In fact, doses from the health agency's stockpile have never been released for any monkeypox outbreaks in Central or Western Africa. Similar discrepancies in response have been noted for other diseases. For example, in 2014 and 2016, it was only after several Americans were sickened by Ebola, among the more than 28,000 cases seen in Africa, that authorities finally sped up the research and protocols to license an Ebola vaccine. Jay Chudi, Nigerian development expert, is saddened that it took monkeypox infections in rich countries before addressing the disease in Africa seemed possible. He said, quote, "You would think the new cases are deadlier and more dangerous than what we have in Africa. We are now seeing it can end once and for all. But because it is no longer just in Africa, it's now everybody is worried," end quote. The World Health Organization will convene a special meeting tomorrow to discuss monkeypox research priorities and related issues. Weatherization and efficiency upgrades can help residents who live in manufactured homes save money. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. More than 20 million Americans live in manufactured or mobile homes. Many newer models are energy efficient and of high quality.
But manufactured homes can be around for a long time, and there's a spectrum of quality in terms of insulation.
Jeanette Lazax is Director of Research and Innovation at Slipstream, a nonprofit that helps people in underserved communities improve the efficiency of their homes. She says that providing better weatherization and upgrading HVAC units can help people in older manufactured homes stay more comfortable and save money on their utility bills. But the upfront costs of these improvements can be prohibitive.
Typically, those that live in manufactured homes are either low or moderate income residents, and so they have to make choices about what they're going to spend their money on. If they're just getting by, maybe energy efficiency is not the top priority.
And many residents are unaware of utility programs that can help them afford energy efficiency upgrades. So Lazak says there's an opportunity for utilities to conduct outreach to manufactured home parks, where they can recruit many residents at once. And more people can take advantage of programs that will help them save energy and lower their bills. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
For years, the medical community has urged men to pay more attention to their overall health. This Men's Health Month includes revised messaging about staying in regular communication with your doctor so major health scares can be avoided. Mike Moen has more.
June is Men's Health Month, and some providers are still trying to convince more men to make room for wellness visits on their calendar. A South Dakota physician says shrugging things off could eventually land you in a medical setting more frequently. Mark Beard, a family medicine specialist for Sanford Health, says men typically start to avoid doctor visits after their teenage years when they no longer have required physicals for things like team sports. He says instead they should embrace having regular talks with their provider. That way, they'll feel comfortable discussing minor issues that can snowball into bigger problems.
Whether that's a joint of concern, or maybe they're having a little bit of chest tightness or chest pain and then ultimately come in with a heart attack, or maybe they've gotten a little bit of headache or numbness and they miss early signs of a stroke.
In a survey last year from Aflac, 45% of men said they didn't visit a family doctor or general practitioner for an annual checkup or a wellness visit. Another 84% said they didn't follow up with a provider for a specific injury. Through social media and TV ads, a lot of products focus on boosting testosterone, but Beard suggests those supplements shouldn't be the only things that motivate men to improve their health.
Just because you're fatigued or you don't have the build or the look that you had when you were a teenager or an early adult doesn't necessarily mean that that's the cause of all of your problems.
He says regular visits can help detect issues that might make you feel worn down. And Beard adds that weight loss drugs and other supplements are not replacements for establishing a healthy lifestyle plan focused on eating better and getting regular physical.